Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au.
InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10. And to celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those who are just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from experts and take your investing to the next level. Simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
Gerard, thanks for taking some time to join me on the podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I know you've had a long flight out here a few days ago and been for a run around the Botanic Gardens here in Melbourne, and hopefully you get some opportunity to do that in Sydney as well. Today, we're going to talk about senior secured loans. We're going to talk about private markets. We're going to talk about credit, all different types of things, and the Invesco business. But before we get to that, let's frame a little bit about you and how you got to here. I'd like to break the ice with you. I don't know if that's a term that you're familiar with.
Yeah, it is. That's a term in the US.
Yeah, okay, great. So I would like to know, as a quick icebreaker, if you could pick only one, the balance sheet over 5 years or the profit and loss statement over 2 years, which would you take and why?
Okay, that's interesting. Cash flow statement is my actually preferred statement. But if I had to choose between the two, I'd pick the income statement over 2 years, because the balance sheet just gives you a snapshot in time. It doesn't give you the journey about how they got there. Mm-hmm. So I like to see how the balance sheet developed, and the income statement will give you the best view of what the drivers were. What's the revenue trajectory been? What's the margin profile been? How has that changed over time? And what's really key to our analysis that we do, and we'll talk more about this when we get to it, is the cash flow. Cash flow dynamics of the business are core to our underwriting thesis, mm-hmm. and that drives debt repayment and debt serviceability. Mm-hmm. So if I had to pick between the two, it would have to be the income statement.
It's interesting. I deliberately leave out the cash flow statement because I know people like yourself may be inclined to opt for that one. But the balance sheet, I figured that may have been your answer to this because you're looking at that side of the ledger so often. Mm-hmm. I figured that that might be the case, but I do see where you're coming from in terms of the journey.
Yeah. So, I mean, the capital structure is obviously paramount, and debt serviceability is, you know, it doesn't matter how much revenue, how much EBITDA you're generating, if you don't know how much debt there is on the balance sheet. So, obviously, you can't do our underwriting analysis without the balance sheet and without knowledge of that. But in isolation, the income statement gives you a better picture of kind of what's going on, what are the key drivers of the underlying business.
Wonderful. Okay, so let's inject some humility at the very beginning of the show and show that we're all human. What's one investment you got totally wrong?
Lessons learned. One of the pre-COVID in the aerospace sector, which is one of the individuals on my team, and I'm a team leader, so we underwrite these things together. We took a look at an emerging market aircraft lessor.
Okay.
Did all of our analysis, you know, got appraisals, got an understanding of what the aircraft were, the maintenance records, everything else. The pandemic hits. Everybody stops traveling. The company has financial problems. We've got to then restructure the company. Later we learn that, you know, what we thought we had wasn't exactly what we had. The aircraft weren't in the condition they were in. The lessees weren't of the quality that we thought they were, and they were sitting in geographies that I've never heard of before. You know, try to repossess a plane from Vanuatu. I don't even know where Vanuatu is, or at least I didn't. Now I do. But it's a very painful lesson. Thankfully, it wasn't a big position in our portfolio, but it really drove home is stick to your knitting, stick to what you know, and be really good at what you know. And if things are too good to be true and you're reaching for yield and you don't have an expertise in that particular sector, it's best to stay away and stick to what you know. Well, you may not be able to hit the triples and home runs. That's not in the business that we're really in. We're in a business of generating consistent returns and protecting our principal. And so, you know, that that is a lesson. Thankfully, it was a relatively small lesson. But I one of the phrases that I like is, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. So we learned our lesson. We're going to take that lesson and move forward.
Well, I'm sure there was some company on the way down in some of those industries, because even the greats, we heard stories of, say, Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway getting caught out in airlines as well after the many famous quotes of avoiding them in times gone by. So
Yeah. And we're in the risk management business, not the risk avoidance business, but there are certain principles that you should adhere to, and really sticking to what you know is critical.
Yeah, I like that that framing. So how about then, let's take something positive. Let's put a smile on that dial. What was something that went well?
Yeah, so similar time frame. We had a glass manufacturer, tableware, glass manufacturer. Really good business. Went into COVID. They were, you know, moderately to high levered, but they were able to service their debt. Go into COVID. Nobody's buying glassware because all the restaurants and hotels are pretty much shut. So we had to restructure that company. The debt traded down significantly. It was trading at levels that basically thought the company was just going to liquidate. So we saw, based on our fundamental analysis, based on our discussions with the management team and, you know, experts that we consulted about how the industry would fare coming out of the pandemic, you know, we saw a really good opportunity to actually add exposure, support the management team, put more capital in. And what transpired was exactly that thesis. Good company. They're an industry leader. They've got low cost relative to their peers. And so coming out of the recession, or out of the pandemic-induced recession, they were remained one of the global leaders. We made multiples of our investment back when we bought at those very, very depressed levels. So that's, you know, that's really drives home the point of know what you know. You know, stay with what you know, invest in businesses and management teams that you know really well, and good things can happen.
It sounds like that was a busy time for you and the team.
Extraordinarily busy.
Yeah.
March, April, May of 2020 was a trying time for everybody, trying to figure out what was going to happen. Nobody really knew, and trying to reassess everything in our portfolio.
You've been with Invesco for a long time, which we'll come to in a moment. You've been directly on the tools and still working with the team now. Throughout your career, and maybe if you could even just take this throughout your life, what are some of the lessons that you've learned along that way? Some of those really prominent lessons that stand out to you that others might be able to absorb on their journey?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been really fortunate to have worked with and been mentored by a lot of people that have kind of taught me the science and probably more importantly, the art of investment management. But really, one of the biggest inspirations for my career was my dad. He came from a very humble beginnings. He enlisted in the Army coming out of college, or coming out of high school rather, spent a couple of years abroad during the Korean War, and that afforded him the ability to go to college. After leaving college, he started a career, you know, as a salesman, selling business forms. And ironically, the first job that I had, this is unbelievable, the first job that I had, I opened the drawer, and there's a ruler from the company, Wallace Business Forms, that he started his career at, which was, I thought, I mean, I don't know what kind of omen that was, but it was, it made me smile, and just the irony of it, where it was fantastic. But anyway, so he worked there for several years. He then, you know, got, you know, knowledge of the space and really understanding that if he wanted to really succeed in his career, he was going to have to do it himself. So he went up, hung his own shingle, started his own business, sourcing business forms and selling business forms. And really the lessons that he instilled on me and the rest of my siblings was you got to go for what you want. You can't wait for it to happen. You got to make things happen yourself. And it's a workaday world. You got to put the work in. And the other thing is planning. He had a lot of one-liners that really resonated with me. One of which was, you know, failing to plan is planning to fail. And today's business isn't done until tomorrow's plan is in place. So he really drove those points home and really resonated with me is you've got to be proactive in your own career. You can't wait for things to happen. You can't be you know, a fly on the wall. You really want to be somebody that's a contributor, that's going to then take those lessons that they learn and those experiences and apply those and help others that along the way that are, you know, kind of coming up in their careers so they can be contributors. So that's kind of the inspiration for my career. And it's really been kind of a bedrock for what I do is be proactive, be a contributor, don't be passive, go out and get what you want.
I love that line about, you know, today's work's not done until the plan for tomorrow is in place.
He was a huge proponent of that.
Yeah, well, it's actually wonderful. It's one of those, you know, if this was a Stephen Covey book, it would be something like, you know, one of the habits of highly effective people.
Yeah.
Is that indeed. So that's great. So, okay, let's talk a little bit about your career specifically then and what you do today. So most of the people who listen to the show and have done for a few years will be familiar with senior secured loans because we've had Ashley from the team come on and talk about, introduce us to senior secured loans, what it is that you do at Invesco and some of the products and services that are offered. So I'll put links in the show notes to those discussions, as well as links to all of the Invesco website and for more information that people can pursue there. But on you specifically, you mentioned just off air a moment ago that basically your time has been divided in two pieces. So wherever you want to start with this, how has your role evolved over time and how did you end up doing what you do today?
Sure. So why don't we just kind of start from the beginning of my career. So I started in a bank training program, a credit training program at Bank of America. Spent 7 years at Bank of America. The boss that I had there, she moved to another firm that ultimately became JP Morgan. And she hired me to come on to join her at Bank of America. You know, at JP Morgan, you know, one of those people that helped me along in my career.
Great.
And really the fundamentals of those bank run credit training programs really give you the experience of fundamental credit research. You know, it's analyzing the balance sheets, the income statements, the cash flow statements, the industries that you're in. So I got a really good base knowledge. And we were managing portfolios for the bank. And so after, so I started in 97, and in 2007, one of my prior managers moved to what then became Invesco and hired me over to Invesco. And I'd always wanted to be on the buy side and really put my money where my mouth is and make investment decisions for, you know, our investors. So I got the great training for the bank, but really the bank's money. And now I wanted to then make that transition and go on to the buy side, which is what I did back in 2007. So unbelievably, you know, 17 years ago, I joined what became Invesco. Then I spent a lot of time, probably several years on from an analyst to a senior analyst, increasing my responsibility, ultimately became a team leader. And we have a team structure where more seasoned investment professionals run a team. I still have individual credit responsibilities for the financial services space and some investment technology companies. But I have team members that cover aerospace, industrials, some consumer, some other investment information technology space. And really what it's for is the consistency of process, which we'll get into more, but making sure that, you know, they can benefit from the experiences that I've had since I've kind of long in the tooth in the industry, making sure that we have consistency of process and I'm a resource when things aren't going the way that they're supposed to. You know, I've been through multiple cycles. We can, you know, work through those situations. And then back in 2015, I picked up in portfolio management responsibilities. Me and Kevin Egan work on the one of the institutional loan products that we manage, several billion dollars under management in that product. And so I spend now about half my time on portfolio management and talking with investors and doing things like this. And then the other half of my time on investment research and helping my team with, you know, the new investments that we look at and monitoring our existing portfolios and working through situations that are not going exactly as planned.
I might double click on a part of this then. So when people think about what it is that you and your team specifically do day to day, how would you juxtapose, say, private markets credit, so senior secured loans, say, and public market equities as an analyst? What are the kind of key differences with what you look for?
Okay, and maybe we should just, if I can, just take a step back and talk about what the senior secured loan asset class is. Yeah, I think there's kind of a misunderstanding of it. I've spent yesterday with a handful of investors, talking through what exactly the asset class is.
Sure.
So it is private markets. You know, the vast majority of the companies that we look at, maybe not the vast majority, but the majority of companies we look at are private. They're not listed. They don't have listed equity. They don't have listed debt. So their financials are on the private side. We as a shop are on the private side. We can take their projections, talk to their management teams, as opposed to some shops that marry up their high yield bond groups and their loan groups, and they stay on the public side. And we can get through that when we talk to the process. But the underlying companies, the average company produces EBITDA somewhere in the $400 to $450 million range.
So pretty big.
Very large. Mm-hmm. And the average enterprise value multiple is 10 times. So you're talking about $4 billion valued companies. And the average loan that we provide to those companies is in the $2 billion range. And those loans are made for mergers and acquisitions, for leveraged buyouts, for capital expenditures, other funding needs that they've got. And those loans trade on a daily basis. They're liquid. So we can trade those individual holdings on a daily basis. And more importantly, we can provide our investors with daily liquidity. So you can invest in the asset class and you can get daily liquidity if you want to redeem at any point in time.
So that's really interesting because a lot of people, particularly here in Australia, as we're talking off air before, a lot of people here in Australia, and to be honest, myself included, think that this is a bit more of an opaque market where you can't necessarily go in there day to day, get your cash back and redeploy somewhere else quickly. So that would probably be a misconception, I guess, about the
industry. Yeah, absolutely. And then two other hallmarks of our asset class is one, it's senior and secured. So as opposed to high yield bonds, which are generally unsecured, we're the first people that get repaid in the event of a default. So we have recoveries that are generally or historically in the 70 to 80% range. And then the second thing is it's floating rate market class. So we moved to SOFR, which is the secured overnight funding rate, about a year ago from LIBOR, which had been the base rate forever. But that's a floating rate that adjusts on a daily basis. So SOFR currently sits at 5.3%. The average credit spread on top of that is about 400 basis points. So all in, your current income, your current coupon is 9.3% in the asset class right now.
And how about then, so a term that people are slowly becoming more familiar with as they get more of an interest in fixed income, how about like the duration exposure for these types of
loans? So duration in our asset class, because we're floating rate, and the average underlying base rate contract, so that's SOFR contract, is 3 months. So you really have, and then that's obviously laddered, not every one of your borrowers has the same date. So the average duration is 45 days in the portfolio, as opposed to high yield bonds, which have around 4 years of duration right now. So we're really agnostic to rates. And clearly the underlying rate is going to dictate what your overall coupon is as it ebbs and flows. Right now it's at historical highs. But the price of the loan is going to be agnostic to where rates are.
So this is for people that are maybe just need to fill in the blanks a little bit here. So effectively what we're talking about is the sensitivity of the loan portfolio to changes in interest rates.
Right.
And effectively what you're saying is because it's effectively floating, well, it is floating, you have less of that sensitivity like people would be familiar with bonds over the past few years.
Well, I think the perfect example is over the last 2 months or 3 months, we saw bonds, which again have about a 4 year average duration. High yield bonds, when rates dropped significantly in October, November, December of 2023, high yield bonds ripped. So they were underperforming loans all year last year until the last quarter. In the last quarter, they significantly increased because rates, on the expectation that the Fed in the US was going to start reducing rates as early as March, the bonds significantly increased in value. And half of that increase, at least, was driven by that duration. So the performance of high yield bonds, total return was 13.5% last year. For loans, it was 13.0%. In the first 6 weeks of this year, and particularly after last Monday, so a week ago Mondays, inflation print in the US, inflation was higher than forecasted. The rate curve increased, and high yield bonds for this year now are positive, I think it's 10% or 10 basis points rather, and loans are up 120 basis points. So they've given up all of that excess performance from last year and given up that and more just in the first six weeks of this year. And it's just showcases the inherent unpredictability of interest rates and what the impact is on duration products like bonds.
So maybe this is a bit of a broad question then. So senior secured loans as an asset class, is it becoming more of a mainstay in people's portfolios and investors digest? They're actually taking in more information on senior secured loans than, say, when you started?
It is, by and large, a institutional asset class, really. Mm. The mutual funds, so people like you and I investing in loans is still, and we're talking about a $1.6 trillion market, but about 5% of that market, so what are $75 billion, is individual investors. Hmm. The bulk of it is institutional investors, whether it's pension funds, insurance companies, and CLOs are about 65% of the buyer base for the loan asset class right now.
Hmm. Which is really interesting, because a lot of people here in Australia with our superannuation system, our pension system, they're familiar with many of the big pension funds having private markets exposure, or what they might term as alternative, just as a catch-all phrase for things that aren't fitting into the standard mm-hmm. definitions. And people have probably wondered when they look down at their statement, and they've probably seen, well, what is that stuff that's in there? And this is one slither of that.
Yeah.
And you can see why, based on what you said so far, why it's so appealing.
Yeah, I think there's a broad appeal for right now for loans. And we haven't done ourselves any favor with how we've named them, bank loans. My family still doesn't know what I do. I invest in bank loans or senior secured loans. They said, what is that? And we just discussed it and described it a little bit ago. But the branding of it just hasn't been great, which leads to a lot of just misunderstanding of really what that asset class is. Mm. But it is still in the alternatives bucket versus a fixed income because of that floating rate nature of it.
Yep, of course. So then let's go back to that point of like, the investment process, which we've alluded to a little bit. So I guess the question is, you say 1.6 trillion, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
So this is that just US? Or is
that is the US.
Yeah.
So the European equivalent is around, I believe, and we have to check this, around a $400 million market. So
okay.
It's a smaller market, but very similar characteristics.
Yeah, right. And so that's quite a big universe. You know, I think that's bigger than the entire Australian stock market, for example,
yep.
to put it in context for people. So where does that research process begin? Where does the investment process start from, you know, an idea coming to you? Or do you find the idea? Is it networks? Is it, you know, are the deals created? How does that process begin?
Yeah, great question. So generally the process is banks. So you've got, you know, Bank of America, Citibank, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Deutsche Bank, those large banks, they arrange the financing for M&A activity that their bankers bring in, mm-hmm. or LBOs that private equity firms are undertaking. They will arrange the financing and then syndicate that financing into our market.
Okay.
So there are over 100 investment management firms that are in the broadly syndicated loan market like ourselves. And we're one of the top five in the US. So we typically get early looks on those types of transactions as the banks kind of want to gauge appetite from some of the largest players in the space. And you know, we can help them, you know, think about structure and pricing and what would work for us. So by being one of the largest, we're afforded a kind of an early look on those and can also get preferred allocations, which is helpful because mm-hmm. in the primary market, we call those primary loans. When they issue those in the primary market, they come at a bit of a premium to where the secondary market trades, just to get people excited and wanting to participate in the primary market versus just investing in the secondary market.
Yeah. Okay. And so from that process, from that point, you would see these deals come into the market. You may get a look in because you are, as you said, one of the top five. Then does the research analyst get appointed by, say, you? You might say, this looks like an interesting deal. Please go away, spend a few weeks on this, mm-hmm. whatever the case may be, and begins that process?
Yeah, so our analysts are all industry experts. Mm-hmm. So if it's a telecom deal, it goes to the telecom analyst. Yep. The telecom analyst will spend a week or two doing their research, and they'll work by virtue of us being on the private side, by virtue of us being very large, and we tend to be one of the largest investors in those companies that we do invest in, and we get access to the management team and to the bankers. Mm. So we can start our diligence. They give us kind of their confidential information memo with all their information, their financials, et cetera, and their, importantly, their financial projections, because we're on the private side as opposed to being on the public side.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can have discussions with the management teams as we do our analysis. The the analyst is an industry expert, so they are familiar with the industry, who the players are, what the competitive drivers are in the industries, and then they also tap experts. There's that expert networks that we can reach out to and discuss if we've got questions about particular subsectors within those industries. And so they bring all that analysis together in an investment underwriting memo that we present then to the investment committee about the merits of a transaction. Hmm. And the analyst can decide if they want to kill it, if they don't think it warrants discussion. If it's cuspy, we're going to bring it to the investment committee anyway and debate the merits of that. But when the investment analyst brings their, and they work in conjunction with the team leader like myself, brings that analysis to the investment committee, they're making a recommendation on how much we should hold, what the probability default rating is, what the recovery rating is, and then what the ESG rating is. And those ratings, in particular the probability default and the recovery rating, really drive our risk-adjusted return analysis, and we can talk in more detail. Mm. We were mentioning that rock-bottom spread analysis that we undertake to really measure relative value and risk-adjusted return. They're taking that recommendation and debating it with the investment committee, and ultimately the investment committee makes the decision whether to go, no go, what the appropriate rating is, and how much exposure we want in our portfolios.
Thanks to you, I've been able to get a glimpse of what those memos look like, and saying to you off air how I've seen a lot of internal investment research over a decade of doing this, and this is the first time I've come across something where I get some of it. I'd say maybe give myself credit, maybe most of it, but then there's a lot of it in there that across the different companies which were profiled, I could sense that there was an intense kind of culture around how you speak, the things that matter, the things that don't, what points need focus and what maybe don't as much. Mm-hmm. And that was actually really interesting to see because obviously, you may not know this, but more so on the public market side, yep. You get to see so much of that rich information that the analysts have pieced together from all different sources and pulled it into this one memo,
yeah.
Which is really, really fascinating for me. There was one point that I was hoping we could tap into a little bit further, which is that default. So the analyst is there sensing that, okay, what's our upside, what's our downside? When you think about, so say worst case scenario, so say in the case of that emerging markets, lessor, I think you said for an airline.
We have to talk about that again?
Yeah, I have to bring it up. But say, for example, that's just an illustration of it, is in that situation, because you're senior secured, you've effectively got the first right over the assets. So you obviously don't want it to get to that. But if it does, you're effectively calculating what the majority of assets would go for in a fire yes. sale, these types of things. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. And so the vast majority of what we do are ongoing businesses versus liquidations. Like in that case, it was really a ultimately it's playing out now, but it's a portfolio liquidation, and you got to look at the liquidation value of that portfolio. But the vast majority of what we do is ongoing concern businesses.
Yep.
So with good businesses, bad balance sheets, they're just over-levered, but you want to keep that business as a going concern because that's going to maximize your recovery. So when we undertake the initial analysis and we do our recovery rating analysis, we basically say, okay, how bad can things get before they can't service their debt? At that point in time, what do we think that business is going to be worth? And then that divided by what we think the amount of debt on that company is going to be at that time, minus bankruptcy costs and other restructuring costs, is going to be our recovery rate. Mm. And then we also layer on top of that analysis of the credit agreement. And if there's any particular strengths or weakness of the credit agreement, that'll have an impact on the recovery rating as well. So that's really the analysis that we go through. And then in conjunction with the probability default rating, you know, we can look at what our expected loss is for that investment over the lifetime of that. And we also bring into consideration expected volatility with the beta of that issuer, as well as those probability default and recovery rating. That's going to give us a lens into what that volatility is. And so then we come up with what we call our rock bottom spread. So what is the minimum spread that we should be getting paid to compensate us for that risk? Mm. And then we've got an RBS. So then the market dictates what the pricing is. So what the spread to average life is going to be for that loan based on the coupon and based on the offering price, what that spread to average life, or we call stall. Stall minus the rock bottom spread, that minimum compensation we should get, gives you then your RBS rock bottom spread premium. And so then we can look at throughout the life of these holdings, and our ratings are dynamic. As the situation evolves, we're going to upgrade, downgrade, we're going to change those ratings. The recovery rating pretty much is stable over time. But the probability of default rating is going to change as the companies evolve. And so the RBS framework allows us to take issuers with different ratings and compare what that premium or deficit is so that we can optimize our portfolios, and our PMs can make educated decisions about, are we getting paid appropriately for the risk that we're taking?
Mm. And I think that comes back to that kind of standardized framework that's been honed over decades in the business. How, in terms of portfolio makeup and construction, how many in a, you know, one of your, you know, say a typical strategy that, say the strategy that you oversee, how many individual positions are in that portfolio? And I guess, can you give us a sense of like the diversification of that?
Sure. So the funds that we manage are typically have around 400 issuers in the portfolio. So that would be an average size of about 25 basis points position. The largest positions in our funds tend to be around 200 basis points or less. We've got the ability to go up to 400 basis points or 4 percentage points in any individual issuer, but we like to run very diversified portfolios. We will have a handful of positions that are kind of between 1.5 and 2 points where we have high conviction, but the majority, I think outside of the top 10 holdings, they're gonna be less than 1% positions in the portfolio because diversity is critical. But we're also an asset class where if things go right, you're gonna get paid back at par. If things go wrong, you're taking a haircut to par. So unlike equities, public markets, you can't make up for bad outcomes with stocks that rip higher. You're really capped out at par. So we really focus our analysis on avoiding the pitfalls and avoiding risk that we're not being compensated for because of that kind of asymmetry of potential outcomes.
So it's kind of like the old cliche that, an inch deep, a mile wide, kind of capture as much of that exposure as possible, limiting the downside.
Right.
Yeah.
And just as a point though, we are discriminating on what goes in the portfolio. So there's around 1,800 issuers in the marketplace. We invest in around 35% of those. So we decline effectively 2/3 of the loans that are in the marketplace.
You did send through quite a few examples, but one of the things that was really interesting to me was the overweight, underweight positions of the portfolio. And again, I'll put links in the show notes to the funds and the literature that you want to read on all the strategies. But the two which were most interesting to me were the fact that you are underweight IT and healthcare, which are the two industries in public markets, at least on the equity side of the ledger, where people seem to be most willing to take on the maximum amount of risk, it would seem, based on valuations. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts and from your perspective, why that is the case.
Yeah, and it really gets back to that asymmetry of risk because we're capped out at par. And generally, people think of healthcare as a defensive sector. So that's our largest underweight in our portfolios. And it's one of the largest sectors in the index is healthcare. You know, we've been actively underweight that sector in a significant way for years. Because it's in the U.S., at least, it's a highly politicized industry. You know, politicians want nothing more than to save their constituents money on their healthcare. Because healthcare costs, I assume here, as well in the United States, the inflation on healthcare costs has been multiples of CPI. So it's very politicized. Medicare and insurance companies are the biggest reimbursers, and they cap what they're willing to reimburse to keep those costs down for their constituents. At the same time, and it's really been exacerbated coming out of COVID, you've got extreme pressure on wages, which is the largest, labor is the largest expense for for healthcare providers. And so you've got this increase in their input cost, pressure on their reimbursement rates, margins have squeezed, and a lot of those issuers are having significant problems servicing their balance sheet. One of the outperformers in our portfolio is actually a name that we're not in at all. A company, well, I won't tell you the company name, but one of the largest healthcare issuers in the marketplace. It's a staffing company to hospital and other surgical centers. And as you can imagine, employment placement agency is going to have significant wage inflation. And at the same time, their reimbursements are going down. So that loan traded from a par to 80 to 60. And our analysts kept reassessing it. At what price does it become attractive for us to buy? And we just couldn't get our arms around it, couldn't understand how they're going to make the economics work because it was a leveraged balance sheet and we just avoided it altogether. And it was a tailwind for our performance relative to the index last year by just not being in that name. So that gets back to the point of avoiding the pitfalls is one way to outperform.
Yeah, so the omission actually leads to the outperformance.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. How about then on the IT side, right? A lot of businesses, we hear of, you know, flashy acronyms like SaaS and businesses wanting to move to cloud-based subscriptions, going off-premise, so many different, you know, trends emerging.
Yeah, you're spot on. And so there's really two things. One is when in late 2021, early 2022, when rates were poised to increase, everybody was expecting rates to go up 400 basis points, which they actually went up 500 basis points. Mm. You know, we underwrote our entire portfolio, really looking for companies that were going to have challenges servicing their balance sheets, given that the expectation for such an increase in base rates. The IT space trades at significantly high multiples, like 20 times EBITDA. And in order for the PE shops that bought those companies to make the economics work, you know, call it pre-COVID, they levered those businesses up 7-8 times. And that those economics work when rates are essentially zero. But when rates go up 400-500 basis points,
of course,
that that becomes unsustainable. So we anticipated significant challenges in that space. So we went from 13% allocation to information technology, and now we're close to 8% allocation to information technology. And it's about 15%, or maybe it's 14% of the index. So we're significantly underweight that. And that thesis played out quite nicely.
It makes so much sense.
And then your other point, that transition from on-prem to the cloud.
Yeah.
And it's really then moved the revenue streams from license sales, so upfront license sales and big cash upfront, to subscription services where you get paid over time. So the cash flow dynamics shifted significantly, and that put pressure on interest coverage.
Yeah, at the same time.
At the same time. So it was a double whammy for those companies. And you know, a lot of those companies are struggling. Mm. You haven't seen a lot of defaults yet. But there's a lot of balance sheets that are very stressed.
It's interesting because most of the time when we see or hear of companies on exchange being, you know, taken private or something like that, we just kind of like dust our hands and we're like, oh, okay, well, we've missed that company, or, you know, maybe it won't be missed, maybe, you know, good riddance in some instances. But then someone's taking control of that, right? Yep. And these things are happening behind the scenes, and many of us, unless they've got the insights like and the access like you have, not many of us can keep up with what's actually happening behind the scenes. And so that's really interesting that you have that dichotomy where you see some of the, obviously we've got massive mega cap technology companies in the US just pole vaulting ahead.
Right.
And but even, you know, despite those, you still have that core publicly listed, you know, network of companies that are kind of accelerating. Mm-hmm. But here we are in private markets where it may be a different story, not altogether, but at least in some senses.
Yeah, and it's not to say those are bad businesses. Those can be very good businesses and businesses that will recover, but it's kind of that classic good business, bad balance sheet.
Yep.
And those will have to be restructured at some point in time.
Mm. How about then, so to the affirmative, what about industries that are compelling to you? So obviously you're underweight these two, but then you're overweight somewhere else. So where does that other place take us?
So at the same time, we were reducing our exposure to information technology. We were increasing our exposure to gaming and leisure. So we took the view, and our industry analyst took the view in the research that he was doing, was that coming out of the pandemic, when vaccinations were starting to kind of take hold and people were starting to live again, that consumers are going to want experiences again.
Mm.
And so that's going to be a tailwind for these gaming and leisure companies. You know, those are, you know, casinos, theme parks, cruise ships, and the like, hotel operators. So that's going to be a tailwind. They were trading at distressed prices, or not distressed, but stressed prices. So, you know, we could get in well below par in a situation where we thought there's going to be tailwinds and poised for improved performance, and then appreciation in the value of those loans. And that thesis played out quite nicely from, you know, call it end of 2021 through, you know, mid 2023. We saw significant appreciation in that sector and the issuers that we invested in. So we continue to increase our exposure. And we've taken some of that exposure off because we think that they've kind of reached fair value and the relative value just isn't that compelling versus other opportunities like chemicals, which we'll talk about in a second. But we remain overweight because we think that those companies are going to continue to perform, you know, very well as consumers have really gotten back to spending on entertainment and experiences. And then the other industry that we've been increasing our exposure to is chemicals. So chemicals got a lot of pressure because of input price inflation. So a lot of chemical companies have petroleum as their one of their key input costs. Petroleum prices went up significantly. Their margins were poised to get squeezed unless they were able to pass through prices to their buyer base. And our analyst, again, you know, in talking to the management teams and talking to industry experts, got comfortable that they would be able to pass those costs along. And so we took the view that was somewhat unpopular, was that these businesses are going to perform just fine. So as the prices started to fall, in our view, the relative value became, and the risk-adjusted return opportunity became very compelling. So we increased our exposure to that sector. And what happened was they were able to keep price, and then petroleum oil prices started coming down. So their input costs started coming down, and they were able to maintain price. So their margins actually expanded. Then they were hit by supply chain issues as well. Supply chain issues caused their customers to overbuy and stockpile inventories. So in 2023, as those inventories unwound, their customer inventories unwound, that was a revenue headwind for 2023 for the chemical space. But because their margins were so high and they've been doing so well and improving their balance sheets, they were able to weather that. And so we remain overweight that sector as well.
It's pretty, it seems obvious now, right, that you talk through those things. I mean, sure, at the time it would have been, there would have been uncertainty everywhere. I remember at the time when we were talking about shortages of critical commodities and inputs, like people will remember things like chipsets and these types of things that were almost impossible to find. At the time, those seemed like pretty scary scenarios for a lot of at least myopic people who couldn't see through the clouds, you know, the stormy clouds ahead.
And I think it gets back to one of the concepts we talked about earlier. You know, we're in the risk management business, not the risk avoidance business. And good, thorough research, talking to management teams, talking to industry experts really give us an edge and give us a better lens into kind of the future of what's going to happen.
Yeah, you get that visibility of supply chains, pipelines, so much that on the other side, we kind of we miss out on, you know, in effect.
Right.
And that is, we often talk on this show about, you know, investing edges, about sharpening that edge, and how you can use insights to drive excess returns. And we've often concluded that private markets are this wonderful frontier, at least here in Australia. Most investors don't have exposure to that directly, even through products like funds, like senior secured loans and these types of things. We don't have that type of access historically, but that seems to be emerging now, which is a really, really compelling thing for people.
And I think it opens up to your point, even on the institutional investor side, there's opportunities to take advantage of market dislocations and market uncertainty and, you know, kind of asymmetry of information. If you're willing to roll up your sleeves and do the work, there's inefficiencies in our market, like that that glass company, tabletop glass company I talked about. Now, a lot of people just left it for dead and just punted out of it. We saw that prices were irrationally low for those that loan that we held. So we took advantage of that to increase our exposure to that name, and it turned out to be a fantastic outcome.
Okay, so I've probably got time for maybe one or two more questions, but I'll be brief with this one, even though it does deserve a lot of time, which is just in terms of how much the top down kind of plays a role in that investment process versus those credit metrics. So, and the fundamental qualitative metrics that you look at as well. How does that kind of interplay?
So we've got a great chart that you may have seen. It's our kind of, we call it the pinwheel. So really the bedrock of what we do is that fundamental research that the analysts do that we talked a lot about. But there's an overlay, a macro overlay that our investment committee really drives the decision-making on. One of that is kind of where we want to position ourselves from a risk standpoint. What we think, you know, is there going to be macroeconomic tailwinds, macroeconomic headwinds? You know, if there's tailwinds, we're going to increase our allocation to risk. If there's headwinds, we're going to decrease our allocation to risk. You know, we've taken the position over the last 24 months, that the up in quality trade was the trade. So we've increased our exposure to double Bs at the same time reducing our exposure to single B rated risk because we thought the economic environment was going to become more challenging. Now, that actually hasn't played out. So that's been a headwind, truthfully, to our relative to performance. We've more than compensated for that with good credit selection, but it has been a headwind by being kind of up in quality trade. So that's half of it. And then there's sector allocation, which we just walked through kind of the sectors that have moved overweight and underweight. But we go through twice a year at least an industry review with our analysts. They'll right. present their thoughts on the industry. What are the drivers? What are the dynamics going on in the industry? And should we be increasing our exposure, reducing our exposure, or just kind of holding pat? And we'll have those discussions with the investment committee. And so they'll be the ultimate decision maker on what, you know, tactically how we position around the industries.
Mm, I like that. I will now just say to people that if you are looking for more information, I will direct you to the show notes because I've got one more question for Gerard in just a moment. But please check out the show notes. And if you're thinking, you're watching or listening to this and you're thinking, well, how does this sit in my portfolio? We've obviously discussed the benefits of the yield and the income focus, but also the exposure to interest rates, otherwise known as duration, and how that might play a role in portfolio. So you can reach out and ask us a question about this and also refer to those documents, because I think if you're listening to this and you're traditionally in government bonds and equities, I think over the next 5, 10, 20 years, this type of conversation will become much more prominent in the discourse, and for good reasons. We're seeing this, more advisors are taking up the option to use the types of strategies that you're talking about in portfolios. And from where I sit, it makes so much sense that we'll see more of that in time.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the opportunity and to kind of get out the awareness of the asset class, because I think it is just not a very well understood asset class and does have a good complementary position in investment portfolios.
Absolutely. So my final question is more just a philosophical one. It's what kind of advice you would have for your younger self if you could go back in time? And this could be anything. It could be from life, business, investing, however you want to take this.
Yeah. So maybe not so much as for my younger self, but advice that I would give any up and comer in the industry, because I've been fortunate to have a lot of people be supportive of me, and particularly my father giving me really solid advice as I've started my career. But I would say, you know, take advantage of challenging opportunities. Take advantage of market dislocation. Don't be afraid of change. Embrace change, because through change, a lot of people kind of hide under the desk, and the people that kind of rise above can really take advantage and catapult their career and make a lot of positive impacts for themselves. So embrace change and good things will happen.
I really like that advice. You're the first person after doing this for many, many years that has said that. So I really, really appreciate you sharing that with us, and we can see that play out, not just in the way you invest, but also in your life as well. And I think it's such it's like a growth mindset, a way to
right.
kind of live your life is just to embrace what comes and take it in your stride. Well, Gerard, thank you for taking some time. I know you've got a packed schedule here in Australia, but it's wonderful to meet you and to share some of your insights
with
the community.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that Rask could help you in 2024. As many of you know, Rask has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies. Which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high-growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high-growth strategy focuses on longer-term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside Rask Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called Rask Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 Rask community members have begun the Rask plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if. You want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy. Insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that, but one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian property podcast by Rask, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of Rask Core, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax. I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nivexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All Rask users get 20% off an annual plan with Nivexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nivexa's software and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nivexa, but they do create some great tools which the Rask community uses each and every day. Number eight, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator Program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number 9, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the Rask YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the Rask network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the Rask Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we're on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. Rask Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the Rask Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000, and hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support Rask and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the Rask Network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.